Support for The Front Porch comes from WVCarFinder.com, matching West Virginia cars to West Virginians who want to buy them. It's a service of the Charleston Gazette-Mail. More at WVCarFinder.com. Hi, you're on The Front Porch. I'm Scott Finn, Executive Director of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, along with Lori Lynn and Rick Wilson. And this week, we're going to talk about third parties. Are they spoilers, or are they important institutions that help us to reshape our political debate? So in West Virginia, the most powerful third party is the Mountain Party, the largest, but also the Libertarian Party is also a really big force here. There's the Constitution Party. What effect do these parties have in general on elections here? And what effect are they having on, let's say, the governor's race, Lori?
Well, this year, certainly, Charlotte Pritt, who's the Mountain Party candidate, is making a big play for all of the progressive Democrats who might feel disaffected by Jim Justice, the Democratic nominee, who is a self-described conservative Democrat, used to be a Republican until fairly recently. So, you know, I think it will be interesting to see how many votes she's able to draw away. And she is, you know, she was a Democratic nominee for governor some years ago. So she's not completely unknown to people. She was a delegate. So, you know, I think as far as serious candidates go, she's credible.
So one question, Rick, is when you talk to your friends, your progressive friends about this election, are you telling them don't vote for a spoiler? You know, Charlotte Pritt could play that role if she takes enough votes away from Justice in order to put Bill Cole in there. Or do you encourage people to vote for the person that they like the best?
I try not to have conversations like that. I'm also mortally wounded that you left out Alice Cooper's Wild Party, you know.
Wild Party?
Yeah, I mean, it's a while back, but you know, it's from the song I Want to Be Elected. I mean, obviously, it's an individual choice, but when things are close, I think people need to think about it more.
How do you make your decisions about who to vote for? Do you see your vote as a strategic thing, or do you vote for the person that you think is actually the best person for that office at that time? How do you make your decisions, Lori?
Well, I mean, just to go to the point that Rick was just addressing, if you could look back to, say, the election of 2000, the presidential election, you know, there's still a lot of residual bitterness on the left for all the people who voted for Ralph Nader, right? So strategically, if Nader hadn't drawn away, I don't know, what was it, like 2 or 3%?
In Florida, especially.
Yeah, I mean, Al Gore would have been president. In this particular election, I think a lot of conservatives recognize that Hillary Clinton is going to be the president. They're turned off by Donald Trump anyway. I mean, so for me, as one of those people, my vote is just kind of a personal way to express the type of person I would like to be president. I mean, I don't want Trump to be president. I could vote for Hillary, but I don't want to be reflected as a vote for Hillary because I don't like Hillary. So
you're voting for Evan McMullen, possibly.
Yeah, I'm going to vote for Evan McMullen, who's an independent conservative candidate.
Who is also, by the way, in real contention, a possible winner in Utah, which is shocking to think
really
about.
Amazing. He's a Mormon, and from there, I went to BYU and polling really well there. So he's making a big play for that. He could be doing really well in places like Idaho, too. They're not really being polled, but he's out there as well. And I think voters under 35 in Utah, he's winning handily. So, yeah, it will be interesting to see what happens there.
So there's that old saying, as goes Utah, so goes parts of Nevada.
It's just amazing that, you know, Utah is a swing state, that Utah is in play. Georgia is in play. Arizona is in play. You know, Donald Trump promised to put states in play that had not been, and he certainly
he did.
Is.
Not even talking about Texas.
Yeah, Texas. I mean, I suspect he'll win, but it's certainly closer than usually is.
In general, one way I think about things is I would rather engage large areas and set up a little sectarian peer group. I'd rather engage where you actually find people. And I think if you're discontent with the way things are going, you should organize and not just think of all you can do in terms of voting for this or that candidate doing a protest vote. It's like what Thoreau said, cast your vote with your whole influence. You know, there's tons of ways of being civically engaged if you don't like something. So thinking a protest vote is the only or the best way to do it. Might be worth revisiting.
Rick, as our resident hillbilly historian, what are some of the other third-party efforts that you find interesting in American history?
So I do think it's interesting to look at, like, when major parties break up. Parties are not in the Constitution. We were talking about this before we started recording, although earlier there was the Democratic, Republican, and the Federalist faction, where left and right doesn't make any sense there. You know, like Hamilton was sort of a big government person. Jefferson was a slave, you know, supposedly the Democrat was a slave. It's really interesting the way it works out. The way the Whig Party sort of collapsed over sectional tensions, and there's like an anti-Masonic party. The guy for whom Wirt County is named was one of the leaders in that, apparently.
Against the Masons.
Yeah.
So that was their big issue.
That was their big one, yeah. I think they thought it was like this conspiracy, you know. To,
well, luckily, we don't have any conspiracy theorists running around government and politics anymore.
That'd be terrible, wouldn't
it? That would be terrible. So people talk about this with the Republican Party, Lori. I mean, but with the Democrats, too. There was a huge divide between the Bernie voters and the Hillary voters. Do you see these sorts of splits happening in these parties? It's definitely a time of change. Or do you think that the parties will find a way to knit themselves back together again?
I suspect they will find a way. But you're right. It is a more turbulent time, I think, with respect to that than we've had in a long time. And I think what you see happening is people feeling like they've been taken for granted. And that, you know, that goes to what you're saying earlier, Rick, about organizing. Look at the libertarians. What they're saying is, you know, I vote constantly for, you know, Republican candidates, and they're taking my vote for granted. They're not reflecting, you know, what I believe, which is small government, but also.
And meanwhile, Trump has shown that there are lots of Republicans that don't really care that much about small government.
Right. And those folks feel like they've been taken for granted. You know, I voted for Mitt Romney, and I voted for all these people who want open borders, you know, what they call open borders in their mind. So they're revolting. So yeah, it will be interesting to see how. I mean,
no double entendre.
They're revolting.
They're revolting.
No, I did not. I did not mean it that way. But just look, for example, in West Virginia at the people who voted for Sanders in the primary, who then said, "I'm going to vote for Trump." Who are those people? What party do they belong to?
They're in the great middle finger, throbbing middle finger faction we've talked about.
You know, the Trump thing reminds me of another early party in the 1800s. That's the Know Nothing Party, or the American Party, which was a really strongly anti-immigrant party. They were an interesting mix too, because some of them were sort of kind of against slavery, but they didn't like all these Catholics coming over here. No offense, Scott, but they would not have been amused at your people.
Yeah, all us Catholics are very offended at the Know-Nothings. Okay, podcast listeners, we're going to take a break, and we come back. Are the West Virginia elections rigged? But first, you're listening to The Front Porch because you want to know more about Appalachian culture, West Virginia politics. And by the way, in this crazy election season, and I think legitimately we can call it crazy, you want to keep up with everything that's going on. You probably listen to the NPR Politics podcast. Well, check out Viewpoint. Viewpoint is a special podcast and program by Ashton Mara. It comes out every Thursday, and it's the latest in West Virginia politics and how we are reacting to this very interesting presidential and local election season. Okay, we're back. So, are elections in West Virginia rigged? You know, we've been talking about Donald Trump talking about rigged elections nationwide. And you hear all the time journalists say there's not much evidence for that nationally. But is it different here in West Virginia? Is it so crazy in West Virginia to talk about that, Rick?
I think there have been cases of possibly rigged elections in the past, and people have gone to prison. There's a famous saying, I think maybe someone associated with the Kennedy campaign, was it Kennedy Sr. said, I'm not paying for a landslide.
I don't want to name names, but there were people in the 60s that got in trouble for all sorts of corruption and machine politics, and some of whom went to jail. So
maybe buying votes. Maybe. There was one case of ballot stuffing, I think. But usually it's not voters impersonating somebody. It's usually, you know, farther upstream where it happens.
I will say this. I mean, when I was a reporter a few years ago, I looked into this, trying to find evidence of it. If it's happening anymore, it's very sporadic and hard to prove. And also, it's not extremely widespread. It's a lot of like maybe individual people that are trying to, you know, be enticed or intimidated into voting a certain way, but not enough that you'd be able to sway a presidential election, much less even like a statewide election.
So can we talk about voting for dead people?
Okay.
In this, like, I'm kind of old school on this. I mean, I think it's really wrong to vote differently than the way the dead person would have voted. You know what I'm saying?
If you vote for a dead person, you should respect their final wishes.
You should vote the way they would have voted.
Some people are leaving things like, did you see the obituary where the woman says, in lieu of flowers, she requests that you not vote for Donald Trump?
I really didn't see that.
That's
wild.
Well, how about the bigger issues here about rigging, which is there was a Center for Investigative Reporting did an analysis of election giving, and they looked for journalists, and they found out that I think by a ratio of like 26-1, journalists were supporting Hillary Clinton with their donations rather than Donald Trump. And I want to say, just to defend ourselves, we actually have a policy here at West Virginia Public Broadcasting. NPR and PBS have similar policies that our journalists are not allowed to give money to political candidates. That being said, is the whole media system rigged toward Democrats in general and especially against Donald Trump?
Yeah, I have complicated feelings about the whole journalists donating to campaigns issue because, in a way, don't we want people's biases to be out in the open? Everybody has opinions, right? Just because you have a journalist badge, it doesn't mean you don't think about these things and have, you know, personal leanings one way or the other.
It's better to have it out than in.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's an argument for that. I think from the media's point of view, you know, if I were running an organization as you are, Scott, I certainly would want that policy because I don't want the biases out there, right? But from my point of view as a consumer of news, it's not necessarily a terrible thing.
Well, I think the other way to go would be if you're really doing your job correctly, people wouldn't be able to see that you have these biases. And the problem is that they do.
Certainly in the case of Trump, I think you're right.
Although Trump has really kind of come off the rails on his own, and you can't get mad at other people covering you, all this stuff you
certainly,
do in front of God and
certainly.
Everybody.
Certainly. And I don't condemn, you know, for example, the New York Times, I think, is one outlet that people have accused of being very anti-Trump. I think the problem for Republicans is you look at that and you say, he's the worst thing to come along until the next Republican. And they look at some of the charges that were made. I mean, the Mitt Romney binders of women thing is kind of infamous in Republican circles.
Look, when I was a teacher, I was a social studies teacher, history teacher, and I talked about issues in front of the classroom. I felt like my role was not to tell them what I believe.
Mm-hmm.
My role was to raise questions, give information, and have them debated amongst themselves. And I kind of feel like the best journalism, look, there's opinion journalism too. That's a different category. And sometimes people get confused. If someone stands up and says, I'm a partisan, I believe these things, and here's my column, I find that useful and interesting. But I think there's a role for the sort of journalist that says, I'm really going to try very hard to keep an open mind. And it's more than just pretending like you don't have opinions by hiding them. It's really trying your best to be that open-minded devil's advocate.
It's hard. I mean, when you're a teacher, yes, you're teaching the subject, but what books do you use to teach that subject? Mm-hmm. What topics do you stress? You know, when you're a reporter, what do you report on? And you can never be perfectly impartial. And I think things are always kind of creeping into the coverage.
And I think it's good to recognize and acknowledge that.
Sure.
Story selection. Workers' comp fraud. What are you going to cover? I always bring this up. When I say workers' comp fraud, and you should do a story on that, Rick, what are you going
to
do?
I'll probably look at, I would be more inclined to look at corporate abuse of workers' comp or shortcuts on worker safety or things like that.
Whereas my instinct might be the guy who claims a workers' comp check, but then you catch him fixing his roof.
That's because you're an enemy of the proletariat, Scott.
Yes, I am.
Well, let me ask you this, Scott. So when you see that 95% of journalists who've donated money have donated to Hillary Clinton, and I don't think this election is that much of an outlier. I think in any election you would see very, very high numbers going to Democrats. Is that a problem in your mind for journalism? And if so,
it's a diversity problem.
What can we do about that?
It's a diversity problem. The same way that we have a diversity problem with things like race or class, we have a huge diversity problem in terms of ideology. And it's a question like who goes into journalism? And I've been a journalism teacher. And so I will tell you that there is a divide. A lot of people who are more conservative, either they don't want to go into journalism because they sense it's a hostile work environment, or they don't want to go into journalism because, frankly, there are more lucrative opportunities in other places. And
so the people who do want to go into journalism are people who want to change the world, make a difference. And those people tend to lean to the left. Is that kind of what you're saying?
I think there's some truth to that. And I think it's because it's such a low paid profession. You know, it's that the people who are in it are in it for other reasons than money. And I'm talking about local sort of regional journalism. At the national level, I think you're dealing with a whole other set of circumstances.
There you're looking at Fox News and like the Washington Times and different things that are very well funded.
I do find it interesting that there's so little competition for something like Fox News because it's been so successful. You would think that some other media outlet would make a run for that
audience.
Like,
for example, the Trump Network that we're hearing rumors about.
Will you watch Trump TV?
Certainly not.
I don't know. I might tune in every once
in a while. I barely watch Fox.
There's only one moon to howl at, you know?
I don't know what that means.
I don't either, but it seems appropriate.
Oh, Rick tried to pass one folksy saying too many
right.
Past us.
We called him on it.
There's only one moon to howl at. And that's the Front Porch for this week. You've been listening to Rick Wilson of the homespun, but often it's a nonsensical phrase, Lori Lynn and Scott Finn. Thanks for listening. There's only one moon to howl at.
I like that.
Sounds good.
I need to write that down. But.